Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale. I'm NabTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today I've got one of our most popular guests, fixed income guru and Sky Business regular Mark Todd, who is Head of Customer Direct in NAB's fixed income currency and commodities business. Mark is widely regarded as one of the best in the business when it comes to explaining the complex world of fixed income markets to retail investors. He's going to tell me they're not complex, but I'm not sure I believe him. And while bonds may sound less interesting than equities, he's here today to explain why what's happening in bond markets right now in particular is sending some strong signals that equity investors need to pay attention to. Mark, thanks for joining me.
How to make bonds groovy.
I think when you say groovy, you pretty much killed it.
Yeah, I think I pretty much killed it.
So let's start with a quick refresh, because I and many others don't follow the bond market quite so closely as we might follow the equities market. And we've probably forgotten everything we ever learned about bonds at university.
Sure.
So talk us through how bonds work loosely, how the bond market works loosely, and where are yields currently?
So if you think about the idea that you have a risk-free rate, a risk-free rate would be a government issuing a security, a bond, and saying that I promise to pay back at a given point in time the money you lent me. That sort of all makes sense, because it's risk-free, because in the event that the government can't redeem it, they'll tax the population more and then they will redeem. So the ones that have struggled to redeem would be Argentina, it would be Greece in the midst of the crisis.
Right. But we look at the US and Australia and sort of first world countries.
You're looking at most first world countries as a way of saying, what's the benchmark? Modern societies that have robust democracies that can have a tax structure that could say, look, they need to pay their money back, and they'll use that money to build out the government infrastructure story, or they'll build out what the population needs, homes, hospitals, things like that.
Roads and bridges.
Yeah, everything. So if you think about, that's your sovereign curve, that's your government curve. That will give you a number. Let's say that's 3%. You know, make it an easy number. 3% in 10-year treasuries. Let's say it's 3% in the Aussie curve, you know, that sort of stuff. If you use 3% as your number, and say that's the government curve.
That's your guaranteed rate of return.
Yeah. So if I, as an investor, I think I can get 3. Now remember, if I invest in that 3, what do I want to account for? I want to account for the fact that they will pay me back my money. I'm taking that assumption. They will have a level of inflation. So when I get my money back, let's say I buy this to maturity, I get my money back, what's the value of that money look like? So they'll say, if inflation was at 3%, the value of that is 0. I literally have made no money. And then I'll account for the tax I need to pay. So if you think about that, then think about, okay, what else do I think are fairly stable term deposit? So I approach it with the same premise. What's the inflation? What's that outcome look like? What's the tax? Well, what are the returns? Once I start applying that message, when I buy other assets, I need to know what margin above that 3% I should get.
For the risk that you're taking.
Yeah, so if I buy equities, I probably want to get a 4% return above that risk-free rate. So I then say, how stable are my assumptions on that 4%? What's the story need to be? So if it's, you see, volatile assets, things that have lost investor support, without naming names, but there are definitely equities that have lost a lot of investor support, because I describe the market right now as intolerantly long. They're intolerant to any missteps. You get it wrong, I will move my holding out. I won't be as supportive of management. That means what's the robust dynamic around that 4%? Like, what are you assuming? That's what makes equities that much harder.
Yeah, this is quite a wide range of variables you need to take into consideration. It's not just inflation and tax.
Yeah.
And the likelihood you'll be repaid.
Yeah. So last week, a few weeks ago, we did a video with the NAB Trade customers about hybrids. Hybrids were about 4% over the cash rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, okay, what's the assumptions you need to make? The major assumption was that the banks, the major banks, would pay back their debts at the first available opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting 4%. That's sort of equity-like return, but you're not buying equities. You're getting into more conservative assets. So when you think of the bond market, what people are predominantly talking about is the fixed rate bond market and government bond market. And then from there, the groovy is corporates.
Yep.
Corporates will come to market and try and issue some securities. Then there's a mixture. There's the hybrid story, which is a mixture of potential equities and securities. And that makes up the total portfolio of when you're starting to build out your investment strategy. So what returns do I need to get? So risk-free rate, above that risk-free rate, what am I getting? Am I getting the right number? That's why the bonds become really important to all the investors, in that when you see your equity holding lose value and you're trying to understand why people are selling good companies, it's because of what they call a relative value. If I went for 3% in the government curve and you're only giving me 5% in the equities, I'm better to go to that 3.
Yeah, for because no risk.
Less risk, no risk, whatever it might be. And then to you know, sort of tease that out a little bit further, it becomes a question of what's the balance? Is it, you know, 10% of all of it? Is it 10% of bonds, 10% equities, 10% REITs, 10% hybrids, you know, go on, 10% cash? So it's, for everyone who'd be listening to this, it's literally crafting your strategy as it suits your interests.
Do you want to create a diversified portfolio of fixed income generally, in much the same way you create a diversified portfolio of equities?
Correct.
Because you've got so many different issues to consider, even in fixed income products.
Right? Yeah. Or, you know, you might be 13 and you just put everything on black because you just don't care, because you just keep can go on. You know, you might back one company, you know, if you're 13 and you like PlayStation, there might be the PlayStation company, and you might just back that because it doesn't really matter over the life cycle. It's over what's the duration that you're going to be investing in. So are you buying, you know, Buffett talks about, are you buying in the growth of the Australian economy? Well, then buy, you know, buy that, buy into the corporate world. Not everyone's doing that. Other people might be trying to say, look, okay, I'm asset rich. I'm cash poor. What gives me better cash?
Yeah, I need income.
Okay, so I might go and get some income around a hybrid portfolio. I might just buy a whole bunch of hybrids because I believe the Australian banking sector can pay back its debts, but I like the cash flow. You know, I don't know. So that's why the bonds become your anchor. You then deploy that anchor further on out into term deposits, really. That's how you think about that conservative curve. So you start with term deposits for 3 months, go out for your bond curve and say, right, if that's the curve, and you can go and find that anywhere. You can go onto NabTrade and look at Bond Advisor. Find that curve and then say, okay, what return am I truly getting? You know, I really like equities, but I just need to make sure what's the actual return I'm truly getting after I take inflation and tax out of the number you're trying to deliver to me.
Yeah. So that's at the retail level. The retail investor generally has a proxy for a fixed income portfolio, including hybrids and term deposits and so on. They're very usually quite unlikely to go and buy government bonds. But what's happening in the government bond market is quite interesting right now, right? So we've had a decade, maybe even a little bit more, of record low interest rates, right? And the Federal Reserve in the US is raising rates. They've said that the economy in the US and globally can sustain higher rates. And they're being explicit about their intention to raise rates further, so it's not simply we've done it once and that's it, we're good. What does that mean for investors? They've been predicating all of their investment decisions, and there are people investing now who've never experienced rates above, you know, 2 and 3%.
Should we be worried?
What's happening? Yeah.
Rates are going higher, should we be worried? We should be focused. I don't know that we should be worried. I don't like the equity guys who say to me, rates are going higher, it's a good sign of the economy is really strong, therefore buy equities.
That's, there are other factors,
I never know when to hear those guys say sell equities. I just don't.
They never like property sales.
Yeah, I don't hear that. So rates going higher. Okay, the function The question I think is relevant, the way I would approach this is ask another question. And the question is, what are the speed at which rates will go higher? Mm. So I feel that rates will go higher because they are so low they have to.
Yeah, you and can't sustain this.
Yeah, what's the speed at which they go higher? So I look at, if I think of interest rates as being agnostic to a jurisdiction, they're not nationalistic. They don't care where they are. So if the interest rate is higher in the US, that means the currency will go higher in the US and it will hold that performance of that economy back. Mm. You know, if you can't export. So there will be a limitation, a natural limitation, because of a few different guiding principles. One is the level of debt that sits in society at the moment.
Mm.
If you come from zero and you move it to one, the impact on your cash flow is dramatic.
Mm.
They are aware of that. So they are looking for consumer behaviour on the basis of what they do to the consumers.
So this is in the US, but in Australia also?
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same thing.
So in Australia,
it's world, it's global.
Global, right. So it's interesting to observe, though, that the same thing's happened in the US, it's happened in Australia, which is interest rates were very, very low. People took advantage of that and have used it primarily to buy property, both as investors and as homeowners.
Yeah.
And so the Australian consumer is now far more indebted than they were prior to the GFC.
Yeah.
And the impact of any increase in home loan interest rates is going to be quite dramatic on people's cash flow.
Yeah.
But remember, the same thing's happening in the US.
Yeah. But remember, that was government policy.
Mm.
So I will lower rates to stimulate activity and save the economies.
Mm.
You can't then come back and say, wow, you borrowed a lot of money.
Oh, well, damn, you guys all went and borrowed.
It doesn't work that way. Mm. And so if you think about what the idea was that we would lower rates, or the world would lower rates, and corporate activity would pick up.
Yeah,
that didn't really happen.
Businesses would also borrow and use it to
There was much more financial engineering. There was much more strategy around paying dividends and borrow to pay dividends and then buying shares back and doing all that sort of stuff. So it's not just in property that people are, you know, borrowed to. You know, it is, the way I think about it is the GFC resulted in everyone piling in to resuscitate the economies of the world. And as a consequence, they've shifted the cost of that to the rest of the world, if you know what I mean. They've moved that out. So I think governments have got high debt. People have high debt. There is high debt everywhere as you try to borrow as much as you can to get away from a depression.
Yes.
In knowing that and spending billions of dollars to get the economies up, I wonder where central banks are prepared to push economies to risk it.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing they're not really going to want to risk that. So
there was not like the late 80s recession we had to have.
No.
We're not going to strip out all capacity by raising rates too high.
No, I don't think so. And so if there's that element. Then the second element that I think is really interesting is not just the government indebtedness, and I'm thinking not Australia but the rest of the world.
Mm.
Lots of government have a lot of debt. Think of Japan and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about that and think about, I'm really interested in the aging demographics of the world, whether it just be Japan, whether it be Germany, whether it be China, to think about the robust response. As we all get older, it becomes a somewhat different response. So what is effectively the neutral rate, the right rate for a 15-year-old versus the right rate, and I mean interest rate, for a 65-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
If you say to a younger person, you can borrow this amount of money to buy that amount of assets, and then you have 50 years of work in which to pay it off, you'd probably say, well, okay, I'll do that.
Mm.
If you're in your 60s, having paid it off, or attempted to pay it off, or be concerned about it, what's your risk appetite for more of that?
Yeah.
And I think that's the second part of the dynamic that the central banks will be thinking about. They'll be thinking about, look at the debt levels, what's the right number, but what's the growth projections look like? Like, what is the demographic telling us they're all going to do? So I think that's one of the things to think about when you're talking about buying into the Australian economy. I think it's glass half full. I'm pretty positive about the Australian economy. But the global economy
is... We've had a number of guests actually on all saying that they're largely positive about the Australian economy.
Yeah. So we're a young place. It's that think about it now in the global context, and I just think it's interesting. I don't think it's going to stop. I think the world is on firmer footing. The point I'm trying to make about higher rates is, what risk are you going to apply to these older, indebted nations to get it to a rate that you seem to think historically it should be? I just don't know that its historical rates are relevant right now. I think it's about where will it play out? And, you know, the great conundrum at the moment is, where is the tax changes in the US playing out in the global economy?
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting.
So did consumers get it? Maybe, maybe not. Corporations get it? Do investors then get it? Where does it play out? So we just saw a GDP print. People were a bit disappointed about the consumer component. And they were saying, I'm very disappointed because it was in the context of getting tax cuts.
Yeah. Theoretically, you all had more money. What did you do with it?
Yeah. Mm. And so what did you do with it? And if you think that interest rates are going higher, which they are in the US, and mortgage rates in 30 years are going higher, you've got an existing mortgage, so you're okay. But what does it do to the psyche if you think rates are going higher?
Yeah.
Refinance rates are going higher. So is more cash flow going out in the form of fixed rate returns? You're paying more debt.
Yeah, the logical response is to pay down your debt pretty quickly, which is what they found in Australia. It's an interesting curve looking at indebted Australian households. So 30% of people have no repayments ahead of schedule. They're in deep trouble and have no additional cash flow if things go pear-shaped. But 30% of people have like 2 years ahead in their repayments or more.
Yeah, the GFC sits with this all the time. You know, it's a really traumatic experience. Even though we didn't have a recession, we are mindful of the ramifications. So people have, you know, genuine concerns and wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, what am I going to do in an economy that's going well? And you hear people and you talk to people, and regardless of, you know, West Australia went through a tough time, I get all that. There are different pockets, I get all that. But you don't have that sense that everyone's thinking we're doing really well.
No, you don't.
Even though we are, you don't have that sense of it. So that's, I still put that down to a GFC overhang. I don't know when that finishes, but I think people are definitely mindful of, I don't want to lose my job. Yeah. So that's that wages story.
Yeah, they've got a greater sense of caution than they had.
I think so.
12 years ago.
And the gap between the rich and the not so rich is obviously much wider. So that, again, that big buffer around, okay, I'm really concerned because I'm not reaping the benefits you tell me are in existence.
Well, this is quite true. The experience of it all is quite different depending on where you see it. So one of the little snippets you fed me before this conversation was that traders in the US have been selling 10-year treasuries.
Getting
short.
They're
shorting. What is that telling us?
They think inflation is coming into the system in the US. It might be bad inflation. It might be driven by commodities. So they think that piece that I talk about in terms of tax and inflation, they think inflation is going higher.
Right.
And therefore, the value of 3% is less valuable. You know, if interest rates were at 1%, sorry, if inflation was at 1%, you get a 2% margin. If it's now at 2%, you get 1%. They don't like that. So they think that the asset managers will not want to buy 10 years at 3% because of inflation. So they're selling on that basis. Now, it's becoming a somewhat crowded trade.
Right, okay.
And crowded trades have the capacity to be fraught with tighter exits.
Yeah, make it a bit harder to get out.
The gate gets much smaller. Not that you wouldn't be able to get out, but the cost is, like, it's such a heavily traded market, that treasury curve. But the market is positioning itself in a way that says they expect rates to go higher on the basis of basically what the Fed said, but also on inflation, predominantly on inflation. So you might see that steeper curve, which, you know, that isn't a great outcome in my mind. So if I lift rates because Gemma is buying more things, then I can say, okay, let's not be silly, let's be cautious, I'll lift rates.
Take away the punch bowl before the party gets out of hand.
Yeah, but if I'm lifting rates, or rates are being forced by the market higher because the cost of the bag is more expensive and you have to buy it, this is a bag of goods or whatever, and because you have to buy it, and those inputs are higher, that's not necessarily a great outcome.
Yeah, that creates a lot of risk for the consumer.
Yeah, or the manufacturer. If you know, if we put tariffs on aluminium and metals, commodities, then the cost of that car is more expensive, or whatever the manufacturer is manufacturing. They say my inputs are more expensive. I've got to sell it to somebody. Where can I get a consumer to want to buy it, or does the corporation take the hit? Corporation got a tax cut, might take the hit.
They might take it, yeah.
So it's not as stimulatory as you'd like it to be if that happens.
Mm. So all of these variables, rates are going higher.
Yeah.
People are heavily indebted,
mm-hmm.
but the economy is generally strong,
mm-hmm.
globally really, which is quite nice. Don't see that very often. Last year was the first year that equity markets marched higher every single month without a single month of decline in decades. So, you know, there's some really positive signals coming out, but also some people are getting anxious. What's the likely impact on equity markets, do you think?
If you get a structural change in the approach to fixed income, and by that I mean you think these rates are genuinely going to be higher in the mid threes, then and inflation is higher, the equity market needs to be able to push those higher costs to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
In the event they can't do that, they'll have to absorb higher costs if it's inflation driven, and therefore they'll either take costs out of their business in some other way or they'll be less profitable.
Right.
And if you have an intolerant market,
anyone
that is adversely impacted by the higher rates based on inflation will find that they will be poorly treated by the investor base.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the yield trade earlier. You know, simple example of how low interest rates affect equity markets. Investors who went to the bank and went, I can only get 2% on my term deposit, would go and buy a high yielding stock as an alternative and treat it in some cases.
That was a massive jump in risk.
Yes, it is, absolutely. But it was clearly seen, right? So many, many people buying high yielding equities and hanging on to those. If you look at SMSF portfolios, which are sort of the core of retirement portfolios in Australia, you will see that somewhere between 40 and 60% of that portfolio in equities is five stocks, four high yielding financials and one high yielding telco. You know, so clearly a yield trade there. I don't think people have an incredible passion for telcos and financials over all other sectors. You know, they were looking for specific outcomes from that. Because they are comparing it with the rates of return they can get from other types of investment, like a term deposit or a bond.
Well, they only compared to term deposits.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
But hybrids, people moved into hybrids because that was also an attractive alternative, and they've obviously increased in terms of their total portfolio allocation too. What do you see happening to that trade as interest rates increase?
The data point that is significant is the fact that so many people have held on to those, that you must wonder how the management of those organisations want to try and think of those investors going forward. So I think there is a challenge around creating income to support what your investors aspire to. And so I think there'll be some challenges around that story, but I think everyone is aware of what that story is. So you're working towards a goal of trying to get them the revenue that they need. And these are self-funded retirees who need this money.
Yeah,
and so the goal is we've got to get them this money. Absolutely. So how do you go about that goal? You're constantly reinventing your business and try to think about it from an investor lens, a customer lens, a compliance lens. You know, you're trying to think of all those lenses with the overarching idea that how do I get the investor what they want? So I guess to some extent it's just a more heightened evolution of change within all those organisations to meet the aspirations of those investors, while at the same time aspirations of customers, be compliant, do all that sort of stuff. I think that there's going to be a far more rigorous approach around these different pieces and try and work out where it fits. So What does that mean? Open dialogue with investors. I can't get there, and these are the reasons why I can't get there. So mm-hmm. I'm archly conservative organisations on the basis you need that.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the customers. I can't give you the service for nothing. I need to pay. There is a cost to the service. I need to be able to work out how to price that cost and make it transparent so you are happy to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to understand a regulatory environment that says I need to be on top of every issue within the organisation, or at least make the endeavours to be on top of every issue. Just try and think about it because they're so big.
Mm.
I think if you take that approach to all of those, then you'll probably have more investor solidarity.
Mm.
You know, because where do you then go if you don't buy those?
It's a conversation that isn't being had, but is interesting that self-managed super fund investors are going to be the example that I use, and they do make up half of all retirement income stream savings in Australia. So
sure.
Of all the money in pension phase in
and
Australia,
they live on it.
Yeah, half of it's in an SMSF. So, and it's being actively managed by individuals, not by professional fund managers, generally by individuals. And one of the challenges with that is that even though people are required to withdraw a minimum pension amount, they will typically stick to the minimum and they will try to generate sufficient yield to draw from cash flows rather than from dipping into their capital. So maybe there is a re-education piece around going, look, you know, you need to start living on your capital in retirement rather than asking asking company directors really to structure their organizations in such a way and their revenues in such a way that it can generate yield rather than capital growth or some other alternative.
Yeah, that's look.
That was the intention of super, and it's not how things have turned out.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we're shifting policy into the way we think about all of those people.
Mm.
And there isn't one answer for all of those people.
No, not at all.
But there's probably a requirement around, okay, how do companies need to behave? What are the opportunities for other types of work so that that you can be an engaged person, earn some money,
earn some income. Supplement your income in another way.
You know, if you think about the way work is changing, you know, I think this is more about a holistic approach around what's my portfolio look like? What's my income opportunity look like? How do I readjust that conversation? So that involves the tax office, that involves the government, that involves a whole policy, you know, strategy, which is probably worthy of conversations, and I'm sure they are taking place. If you rely solely on your income from your investments, listen to this podcast, get as much information as you can, be completely comfortable that you know what you're doing. I don't think you need to take greater risk. I think you need to take greater involvement. Now, that doesn't mean every minute of every day, but that means having a plan, and then adjusting that plan to what's actually happening in the market, so making sure that plan is still consistent with what you need. That's all fine. Just do that. So, you know, everyone talks about modelling. You can do your own modelling. You know, if the dividend yields drop by 10%, what will that do to your life?
Yeah.
Just that's a model.
Yeah.
If I earn $100 and I only get $90, what would I do?
Yeah. Which levers would I pull? Would I spend less?
Would I change my investment
portfolio?
Is there something I could do? So what would I do? And you should do that now, not because I think there's going to be a change, but it gives you an insurance policy.
Yeah.
You know, we're on $110 rather than waiting for the $10 to be lost and therefore you then go and find another role. And I don't know what it is, but there's, you know, there's something to be thought about around spending some time understanding what that opportunity might look like.
It's really good. There's one last question I have for you. So when we're talking about this low rate environment and how people do seek to get returns greater than the low rates that are available from a term deposit, for example, one of the things people also need to think about is that plenty of the equities that they invest in are generating above average returns because they pay so little on their borrowings right now. So longer term borrowings, you know, if you think about infrastructure, for example, it takes a long time to build, it's expensive, you borrow money to do it, and then you can happily pay everybody back later on.
Sure.
What should investors be thinking about when they're looking at these low rates and the equity portfolio that they have? You were just talking about doing some stress testing, which I think is super valuable.
Well, so if you think rates are going high, which we think they're going to go higher, then you'll get a higher term deposit.
Yeah.
That's the way to think about it. So that's one thing. So what's your balanced portfolio? How much do you start with in cash?
Mm.
Because you think those rates are going to go higher. So just, you know, and will that, if you have more in cash, how will that impact on your lifestyle?
Mm. So I
think it's literally, okay, so the first thing I think you do is work out what all the asset classes are.
Yeah.
And is there subclasses in that?
Mm.
So if I think property, do I think REITs? Okay, well, I might look at REITs as well. So what returns are REITs getting me?
Yes.
And when everyone says to me, don't buy that because rates are going high, I'm like, okay, that doesn't really work in my mind because if I'm getting a 6% on a REIT, is that worth $5 of my 100? Well, it might be. And what do I need to know about that? Well, I need to know that the tenants will pay back their rent and then there'll be a rent negotiation at some point in time. So, you know, when will that be? What do I think? Do I think the Australian economy is doing well? Okay, that might be okay. That'll, you know, what will that 6% grow at? It might grow at inflation, whatever. Mm. Whatever, you know, just it's they're easier to understand because you can go and see the properties.
Yeah, they're quite
tangible. And you can look at the tenant and you can say, well, I think that's going to be okay, but that might be worth 5%. So look at, if that's 5%, your cash piece might be 20%, I don't know. Mm. And then just start getting a bit more granular around all of it. If it's REITs, is it, you know, major bank, ASX 50, whatever, is it that piece? Is there a small cap piece that you want to look at? And in the small cap piece, you might say, you know what, I'll pay some fees. Why don't I find a small cap manager that I like and then put 5% in that?
Yeah.
So then you're starting to say, I've actually got a strategy rather than, okay, I'm chasing yield. What's the highest yield? That's the highest risk. Because you're not able to then, you know, remember, the only person that loses sleep over your investments is you. Other people might feel really bad, and they'll feel bad because they might lose their source of employment. But it's permanent for you, and it's your engagement. So, you know, if you handing off to other people, I understand the role of other people, but remember, it's your money.
So one point, just coming back to this possibility for people to go, look, you do always have the option of drawing down on your capital in retirement. That is an option. Many people don't like that option, but it's there.
Their kids don't like that option.
Maybe that's what it is. the longer term inheritance strategy is always nice. But one thing for people to consider is you have 2 years in cash, right? 2 years worth of pension payments in cash, and then the remainder you can invest according to the allocation that you were talking about. And so then that fear of markets really coming off.
That's a plan.
Is something that you can live with. If we talk about the GFC, you know, it bottomed out in March 2009.
Didn't feel like it at the time.
It didn't feel like it at the time, but it came back very strongly. So 2 years in cash would have saved most people from the worst of the GFC.
Yep. And the
not
GFC,
all of it, but the worst of it by a long margin.
And the GFC is a once in a lifetime, and hopefully we don't ever see that again. So then it's just a function of what information do I need as opposed to what advice do I need? What information do I need? And that's not to say don't get advice, but what information do I need before I go and get advice or before I make a decision?
Yeah. What am I specifically seeking advice on, given that my own research?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I've done the research. I want to know what to invest in or what advice I need to get. So I want to know what questions. And then you can, you know, having done some research, you can make sure you've got the right responses to those questions because you think that person is on top of that brief, whatever that brief might be.
Mark, thank you so much. As always, some incredibly helpful insights, and we covered a lot of ground today talking about sort of macro market issues, but also what you do at a personal level. Always fantastic to have you on the show.
Happy to be here.
That's all we've got time for today. We hope you found it useful. As always, thank you so much for joining us. And if you have any questions or feedback, please feel free to email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.